This is Glenn Fleischman talking to David X. Cohen of Futurama for Boing Boing. David is the co-creator of Futurama. It's co-executive producer, if I have that right, with Matt Groening. David used to write for The Simpsons and created the show with Matt, created Futurama with Matt, to fulfill his inner geek. Your inner geek is sort of your outer geek, too, isn't it, David?
It is. I'm kind of a geek through and through, no matter whether you look from inside or outside with your geek probe.
Well, I was going to say, when Futurama started in 1998, it was kind of, it was out there alone on its solitary mission, maybe with some, sci-fi shows, but geeks weren't still in ascendant yet, right? We weren't running the world. Do you look at the shows that are on today and you say, Eureka on the Sci-Fi Network, or which was very, very, very geeky, or on the mainstream side, The Big Bang Theory, did Futurama pave the way for the celebration of geeks on mainstream culture?
Boy, I would like to think so. I think, also just the landscape of television has changed since then in a way that has benefited our geek viewers, and that is that the audience has really fragmented, and whereas people were still more focused on the broadcast networks when we started up in 1998, now the audience is much more spread out, even just in that 14-year span. And so you take an audience that is our hardcore science fiction enthusiasts who watched it at that time and were maybe not quite as big of a number as they would look for a network show, and you take those same people and have them watching on a cable show, suddenly that's a pretty good size audience. So that fragmentation has some upside for a show like ours.
Well, I was going to say, is Futurama the most canceled and reborn show in the history of television?
Maybe. I don't have the statistics, but we're definitely in the running. You actually asked that question at a good moment, because last week we finished writing the last episode that will be on next year, which by our means of reckoning is our fourth last episode ever. We have a writer, Ken Keeler, who specializes in those. He's written all four of them now. So, we don't know our fate for the future, but we're kind of getting used to that at this point.
He writes some beautiful last episodes, let me tell you. I gotta say, the devil...
You've had a rough road when you're getting good at writing your last episode ever, from experience.
Yeah, one hopes. But, the rocky road seems to be. I know that in the original run, you had four seasons on Fox and on broadcast TV, and the show got shunted around. Fox had a lot of sports programs. It was following The Simpsons sometimes, but it was hard to find. When I used to use this thing called television with a tuner, which I don't quite understand how that works anymore, I used to have to try to find the program and watch it when it aired, and that seemed a little difficult back in the late 90s.
Yeah, we ended up in the death slot, which was Sundays at 7 o'clock on Fox, and of course, Fox has football on Sundays, and the games go for an unpredictable length of time, and about half the time we would get knocked out of that slot by a long-running football game. So then we thought we'd either be off completely or off in half of the country. So that was not a good slot. In fact, you knew it was a bad slot because it was 7 o'clock on Sunday, and Fox's slogan was, "The fun begins at 8." So you suspect that that's not their number one time slot. So. Yeah, once we were there, it was tough. We actually did pretty well in the slot after The Simpsons, but that's such a valuable slot for launching new shows that they only would let us stay there for a limited amount of time, and then they wanted to rotate new things in there. So, unfortunately, we didn't get the comfort of that slot for long.
Well, and then I'm sure a lot of listeners know the history because they are Futurama fans and thus listening to this, but, I know you came back in reruns on, it was Cartoon Network first, right? It was... after the show was off the air off broadcast TV?
That was actually the beginning of Futurama's resuscitation. We went off of Fox broadcast in 2003, and in fact we were only on in 2003 because we had so many shows that got knocked off the air in 2002 that they had enough to keep us on another season in 2003. But in 2003, Cartoon Network's Adult Swim late night programming picked up the reruns of Futurama and Family Guy, and started running them late at night, 12, 1, 2 a.m. And everybody just said, "Well, we'll settle into that for life. that'll be the burial place of Futurama." But strangely enough, people started watching even at that strange hour. And Family Guy led the way with a direct-to-DVD release, and then back on the air, and that worked. And then they said, "Futurama, you get next in line." And we did four DVD movies and then back on the air on Comedy Central. So Cartoon Network definitely paved the way. In fact, our premiere is on June 20th on Comedy Central. I'll plug that as long as you're raising the question. We'll be on Wednesdays at 10 p.m. this summer on Comedy Central. We have reruns airing now also on WGN America Cable Network and on the weekends on various broadcast stations, weekends only. So it's on three places in most.
I think one of the things that's interesting to me is, you know, so I've been a fan of the show from the beginning, and I'll disclose, I know your sister. Sister's a good friend of mine. So I knew about this show way back when, and...
What?
You had no idea.
Wait a second. Something sounds crooked about this whole interview.
This interview is over. And so I remember hearing about it before it launched a little bit. Your sister revealed only a few secrets. And, you know, I love the voice talent. I love the show, and you've kept the group together for so long. But what's been fascinating to me as a longtime fan of the show is that the steamroller you've had now, you know, a lot of shows, they're going on for years. You've had all these breaks in production. You come back, you keep reassembling, you know, all the voice talent. I know a lot of the writing team and production team. But what's the deal now where you're actually popular? I mean, Facebook, 22 million likes. Like, what is that about? See, I thought you were like, you know, this little show that only a few people like. Are you finding that your audience is so disparate that Facebook's the only place they come together?
Yes, I think that's one way of putting it. If people take a look at the Facebook page for the show, which is administered by Comedy Central, it's in the top 10 of all Facebook pages for TV shows, which is pretty shocking because, you know, we're certainly not in the top 10 for all ratings of all shows. And this includes broadcast shows, you know, all shows. I'm counting when I say top 10. And I think there's two main reasons for that. One, our fans are very internet savvy. On average, I think the chance that one of our fans is poking around on the internet looking up stuff for the show is much higher than the chance a fan for many other shows would be doing that. And then secondly, the show's been around a while and has fans in other countries, and so the Facebook page would reflect that, whereas the U.S. ratings on the network, whatever, might not. So you get a combination of the worldwide fan base of the show and the internet savviness of our fans.
It's still fascinating. It's like 3% of all Facebook users have liked that page, which is sort of astonishing as a number.
I'll take it. Probably a virus of some kind looking for them, but even so, no problem.
It's Bender. It's his responsibility. And I think, you know, there's something about the show that I think appeals to sort of the, there's this, not just a geek interest, but there's interest in science, like the Mythbusters form of science, where it's real science, but it's also fun, engaging, and people have this kind of almost macho geek science aesthetic now. And the show has always been smart about math and science. And I know your background, you went to graduate school for math and had something to do with pancakes at the time.
And yes, it was. I went to UC Berkeley I was a graduate student in the computer science department there, and I was doing some theoretical computer science work, which is sort of the border between computer science and math. And I worked on a problem called the pancake problem that Bill Gates actually has published a paper on in his pre-Microsoft days, believe it or not. So that's my one thing I have in common with Bill Gates, spending time on a largely worthless and theoretical math problem that is still kind of fun to work on. So I published a paper on that before I dropped out to write cartoons and moved here to L.A. And what was the question again?
Oh, I think it's that the crew you've got together, you were a bunch of science nerds.
Right? Oh, right, science.
Astrophysics and math.
And I have to credit some other people on the show. Ken Keeler, who's been writing since the very beginning, actually puts me to shame in that department. He has a Ph.D. in applied math and two master's degrees. We had a writer, Jeff Westbrook, with a Ph.D. in computer science. Couple other people, Bill Odenkirk, who now writes for The Simpsons, along with Jeff Westbrook. He has a Ph.D. in chemistry. Stuart Burns, who wrote for the show, had a master's degree in math. So it was genuine science credentials among the writers. And we do try, when possible, to avoid the cliche of the evil scientist who is using science to destroy the world. You know, we make jokes about that, but at the same time, we try to make science the hero sometimes, as opposed to just the villain, which is what I feel the more standard cartoony take on science is. You know, I've invented a death machine to destroy the universe. Well, we had an episode last year, for example, where an actual math theorem proven by Ken Keeler saved the day. We flashed the theorem on stage. This was an episode called The Prisoner of Benda, where all the characters had switched brains, and it wasn't clear with the apparatus they had available whether they could ever get back to their original brain, because there were certain rules about you can't switch back with somebody once you switch. So Ken actually proved a theorem in group theory, or perhaps graph theory, depending on how you look at it, and we flash it on a blackboard at the end, and that saves the day. So we do try once in a while to make real science the hero of the show.
Well, and I think that's one of the things I like about the show too is you push the animation form in doing ridiculous things that you can't do in live action footage. And you know, there's farce and there's ridiculous things, and people, you know, the 8-bit episode segment of the finale of last season, things like that. But then the other side is there's some very clever things like the Farnsworth Parabox is one of my favorite episodes about multiple universes and so forth. Well, it seems like the science fiction is solid, even where the even if the science isn't back, the science fiction. I had someone on Twitter asked, in fact, like what they were asking about, you know, which obscure science fiction movies do you try to reference in the show?
Yeah, we rarely, you know, contrary to popular opinion, we very rarely start out an episode and say, this episode is going to be a parody of The Matrix or, you know, Star Wars or whatever it is. We actually don't do a lot of that. More often we just borrow or steal, depending on how you're looking at little ideas or sci-fi ideas that we like within the show, and we're combining them together. I'll give you an example. There was an episode where Fry joined the police last year and ended up on the Future Crime Division, which is very much like Minority Report, except that once he got on his light cycle and began his motorcycle chase, it was Tron. And then they went to the 3D planet and it was Avatar. So it's like it's more of a smushing together of different ideas from different things than straight up parody, usually, I would say. And then just as far as the science fiction in general, I'm happy you brought that up, because we do pride ourselves on trying to deliver a genuine science fiction story, and that's something we were very unsure about when the show first began back in 1998, because there's not a huge amount of history of sci-fi comedy in the world. It's actually a kind of thinly explored area. There's some, but there's not a lot. And you're immediately faced with the question, you know, well, maybe we shouldn't be too nerdy about the science fiction and really try to tell a sci-fi story, because where's the jokes going to be? But something we've discovered over the years is that the more grand and dramatic and gripping the science fiction story is underlying it, the better the jokes play. It turned out to be like a double bonus for us once we realized that that when people are really wrapped up in the drama of it, and that it's more of a release when you get a joke, so the jokes actually play better. So we've gradually committed, I think, more and more to trying to tell really good sci-fi stories, and I think it's only helped the show. So thank you. Yes, I appreciate the chance to yak about that.
Well, it's also, I think you address real science issues too, like that border between using science fiction and even the farce in it to explore that border. There's the issue of the whole episode last season about intelligent design that you explored. It was a beautiful episode in that there was a statement at the front, and Farnsworth, of course, Professor Farnsworth comes out against intelligent design. The crew winds up being shipwrecked on a planet. Electronic beings evolve, and there's that beautiful symmetry at the end where the electronic beings are denying the possibility of a creator. And you don't actually shy, it seems, from controversies like that that involve science. You're a skeptic. I know you've the episode I know you were involved in at The Simpsons, Lisa the Skeptic, which is a famous episode looking at that kind of thing. Do you try to work skepticism and that notion of the challenge of science and confirming things into the show, or does that just come out naturally as you evolve these episodes?
I think we do consciously work to find some areas like that, because anything which is a big debate in real life usually does lend itself to a good dramatic story. So the one you mentioned, which is sort of the evolution debate, is certainly great fodder for Futurama, and I think we get a lot of leeway in the same way The Simpsons does, and South Park, any of the cartoons, to deal with these subjects that a live-action show doesn't. You know, it seems so much less like a lecture when you're watching cartoon characters debate these things. And you know, you can do crazier things. We can make it robots instead of living beings that are evolving, and suddenly you're free to talk about robots evolving in a way that might seem like an annoying lecture if it was living beings who were evolving. So it is something that I think it works better in cartoons than in live action comedies. So we do look for these things because they're just naturally dramatic subjects where people have different opinions. And by the way, as you pointed out in that particular episode, we do try to show two sides to the debate if we can find two sides. So that particular episode, is it even remotely conceivable that someone could design the initial creature and then set evolution in motion? Yeah, it's remotely. I'll concede that it's remotely conceivable. You know, the evolution is happening, but what happened in the beginning? Maybe it was that the professor dropped off some microorganisms that he had designed. You know, the great professor in the sky. So we try to find the second side to an argument so that it is not pounding the viewers on the head the whole time. And then another example, not necessarily from the world of science, but we had one called Proposition Infinity a summer or two ago based on Prop 8 here in California, which was legalizing gay marriage. But in our episode, it was legalizing robosexual marriage, robot and human. So again, these kind of things that are a raging debate in real life, good for cartoons.
There's actually, I think when we talk about love, I think that's a good transition into Boing Boing's own Dean Putney had a question, which was, how are the more emotional episodes of the show received? And I wonder that too, because I had the great privilege, thank you very much, of attending a table reading a couple of years ago. And I was talking to Billy West afterwards, the voice of Fry and the professor and Zoidberg and a million others on the show and elsewhere. And Billy said one of the things that he really enjoyed about this will be news to you. No, not really. About being a voice performer on the show is the heart in the show. And it's silly and it's full of science and you have farce, but there's an emotional center to this show that I find is lacking from a lot of, you know, sitcoms, is lacking from reality television. The romance between Fry and Leela. Fry may be kind of an idiot or most of the time, but he has a remarkable heart. And even in the first couple episodes of this season, you're already seeing it. You know, another of my favorite episodes was The Devil's Hands or Idle Playthings, one of the many finale episodes, which I thought was beautifully moving, at the same time just, you know, layer and layer of hilarious things, and the correct use of the word ironic appears in that episode, a rare trait. But so can you speak to that, the emotional heart of the show, as opposed to, you know, being a silly funny program or being able to express science ideas, that heart that's beneath the surface?
That's another thing that we've sort of developed as the show went along, and it's a long feedback loop in animation where you do a show and it's done a year later and then you see how people react to it. And it's not like a sitcom where you see if people are laughing or perhaps crying in the audience while you're taping it. So we have a long feedback loop. So, you know, if something works, maybe we try it again a year later. So early on, the first couple episodes we did that I would say fall really squarely in this area of really going for the heart, where there was one of Fry's brother called The Luck of the Fryrish,
yes,
where he found out what happened to his brother in 1,000 years in the past, and had a touching ending where he learned the fate of these lost relatives, and then that actually worked really well. And so then the next year we did this one where with Fry's dog, which is now probably the most controversial episode we've ever done.
Yeah, well, you broke my heart, David. You broke my heart.
Yes, Jurassic Bark episode. Yes. I won't go into detail for anyone who hasn't seen it. But
too sensitive.
You like dogs? No one, nobody who likes dogs has ever survived with a dry eye. It's pretty harsh. Yeah, we had some funny comments on the internet. I remember after it aired, like, I hated this episode. They made me cry.
Exactly.
So divides people a little bit.
Fry is always sacrificing his life for Leela. I think it's, I've given up counting the number of times that Fry has pretty, you know, for being the kind of, it's self-consistent, I think, with the way the character's written, is when given the chance, he will give up his life again and again and again and again if necessary.
Yes. It's it's another thing where you say, like, can you do this and do a comedy show? Well, usually do work pretty well together because you're invested in the emotional story. Oh, then the laugh's a big release from that emotion you're feeling. But I feel like it is a lot easier to get a laugh than a tear in a cartoon. There's no way around it. And you can just show a cartoon character getting hit on the head with a bowling ball and you're pretty much guaranteed a laugh. But to get a tear, the person has to be pretty wrapped up in the story. So On the rare occasion that we try it, I do feel good when I read that internet post that we actually got somebody worked up to that state of emotion.
You know, the other interesting thing for me about Futurama is that I find people who are not traditional science fiction fans, who are not particularly, you know, they don't have a affinity for animation. And my wife is one of these folks. She doesn't really watch animated shows. If I turn Doctor Who on, the mere sound of the music drives her from the room because of the kind of tension in the show. She is a huge Futurama fan. We wander around the house saying good news, everyone, and each pound of which weighs over 10,000 pounds. You know, we've adopted the catchphrases. Do you find that there's an audience of people who watch the show who are surprised at themselves for watching it because it's the only kind of this thing they watch?
I don't know that. I've heard that from a few people very similar to you. Say, like, I watch it, and my husband or wife finally started and it became our show. So I feel good about it, but I feel I have a very small sample of people personally reporting that to me. I don't know. Nielsen doesn't break it down that finely. I don't know what the worldwide statistics are on people unexpectedly becoming fans of the show. But we don't succeed in every episode, but the ideal Futurama episode is one that has a grand sci-fi story, as I said, but has a really good personal story. That doesn't have to be a tearjerker, but just that the characters really care about something that is based on real human emotion and human behavior. And so when I say human, that could apply to a robot or a giant lobster or anything like that in the show, but that their concerns and feelings are things that real people on Earth can sympathize with. So we always try to bear that in mind, no matter how crazy that science fiction story is going. So our ideal story succeeds in both of those areas. And again, not always 100% success, but that's what we're shooting for.
How did Hypnotoad become so popular? That's what people ask about the most. Like, I had several questions about why is there not more Hypnotoad, which explains, you know, that's explained by Hypnotoad. And the Everybody Loves Hypnotoad bonus on one of the DVDs. I know I watched it for all the Easter eggs in it. What happened with that character, and why do people want so much more of it?
Well, you will be getting more, first of all, so just assured. Now, secondly, the fact that people are even asking about Hypnotoad demonstrate that they've fallen prey to Hypnotoad's hypnosis and are just doing his bidding. So that wasn't their own doing that they asked that question, but I'll answer it anyway. Hypnotoad, for anyone who doesn't know, is this toad who does not speak but hypnotizes you with his swirling eyes. And in the future, he has the most popular show on television where he sits there and hypnotizes you for half an hour each day. It's called Everybody Loves Hypnotoad. And I think the original thinking was just that that was only about one notch down in entertainment value from a lot of what actually is on TV. So it's only a slight exaggeration of how hypnotized people already get by just whatever happens to be glowing on the TV set when they turn it on. As far as the full-length Hypnotoad show, which we actually put out the DVD bonus feature on one of the DVD movies, I forget which one, I like to describe that as 5 minutes of entertainment packed into a 22-minute program.
I sat there staring at the screen. It was wonderful.
There is some entertainment in there. You just have to wait very patiently to see it.
So tell me, finally, about this upcoming season. I feel like the show has change season to season. Sometimes you've had a different form, like the straight to DVD movies, in which you've been able to explore things at greater length. Sometimes you're in a different, you know, audience. You're moving to this more narrow cable audience, but a broader internet audience with downloads and iTunes and everything else. What's the new season like? Is there a way to summarize it? Or, you know, it's going to be more of the same plus, and, you know, different new characters, new approach. What are we going to see?
Well, first of all, I'd say, I would describe this season as it is full, 100% full blast, classic Futurama. You know, we've survived the hump through the cancellation, the DVD movies, and got our crew back, and are, I would say, kind of going strong in the back in the half hour format for the first time in quite a while. We're not picking up that science again from scratch. I think we've been doing it for a couple of years now. So I think these are really good classic Futurama episodes, really as good as any we've ever done. There's perhaps a little more, a few more flying body parts. That's big this year. by the way, one of our episodes on the premiere night is called A Farewell to Arms. That's to be taken in a more literal sense than Hemingway's version. So you'll see what I'm talking about. But also, I think Fry, as far as the overall huge arc of the show, which we try to keep moving a little bit, I think Fry is buckling down a little bit over the next two summers and trying to win Leela once and for all, and that's going to be the ultimate arc of the next two summers. So that's where we're heading with the current season, the current series finale, which will be 2013.
The finale for now. For now.
For now. For now.
Because Ken needs to write another finale. Another
That's right.
end of season. David, a lot of fun to talk to you about this, and thanks for coming on and talking to me here at Boing Boing.
My pleasure.